go to work.
That's it. Freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. 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 With a W and a W
and a W dot. And yes, up next on freakradio.org, it is indeed Bathurst Spears Broadsides. Stay tuned.
Know me and the ways of my heart, and the young man that I once was could have torn our love apart. When you're young and always looking at the far side of the hill, you might miss the fairest flower standing by you very still. Love, 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 such is love, wondrous love. Love, 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 such is love. This love, love is never like the stillness. The stillness, love is always passing by. Love must flow up like a river.
Like a river,
tried to hold love back, and love will die. If I know.
Peter, Paul, and Mary from their album. Well, it says Such is Love, but I wonder if that, in fact, is the name of the album or just the name of the song. I don't know. But there it was. And you'll be hearing a bit more from Peter, Paul, and Mary, probably songs recorded 20 years ago, although maybe this is a bit more recent. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org, as you may have heard a moment ago, and this is indeed Bathrobe Spear's Broadsides. I am, in fact, Bathrobe Spear, and my broadsides are right here. Presumably yours are right there. And if you want to connect, there is a phone line, 427-3772. 831-427-3772 is the call-in number here. Later on, around 7:30, perhaps a little before, I'm expecting a few calls from homeless advocates, as say advocates of ways of ending homelessness and restoring civil rights for people outside while they struggle along, and maybe even finding housing for them and employment. Jeremy Alderson does the Homelessness Marathon each year, and he's currently engaged in a debate, online debate, with another homeless activist, Mike Rhodes, who is instrumental in getting together the Fresno lawsuit, the Kincaid lawsuit that resulted in a $2.3 million victory for the homeless of Fresno. And that was quite something. In fact, I keep hoping we're going to emulate it here. And using the rather egregious blunders of the city attorney John Barisone and chief ranger John Wallace, who are continuing to engage in just outright constitutional violations of the law regarding homeless people, like seizing and destroying their property without storing it, like cooking up injunctions against homeless people for the crime of sleeping downtown when they have no place to sleep that's legal every night, as 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people compete for maybe 150 to 200 beds, which will shrink to, gosh, since I'm told that the Paul Lee shelter is not a walk-in shelter but a program, it's probably going to be about 40 to 60 beds for that huge number of people who are outside. Now, many people don't want those beds because they don't like the services. They don't feel they're able to use them and work at the same time. They can't be partners in there. They can't bring in their pets. They have to abandon their vehicles to the depredations, the kindly ministrations of the Santa Cruz neighbors and police, which with increased permit parking restrictions throughout the city becomes more and more problematic. Not to mention depredations by other people and homeless people themselves on each other that goes on as the economic climate gets nastier. Anyway, these two, Mike Rhodes and Jeremy Alderson, will be, I'm told, calling in around 7:30 to talk about what's going on in Fresno, and where there's a pack of money being thrown at homelessness, but apparently mostly to go to consultants and temporary Band-Aid motel vouchers for a month or two solutions, at the same time that they're trying to get rid of homeless encampments like New Jack City and the H Street encampment that the homeless people themselves have set up because they have to survive. It's easier and safer to do so in communities, and that's what human beings usually do when they're threatened. They, in many cases, they start pulling together in spite of the attempts of the society to criminalize them and tear them apart. And I keep hoping that's what folks here in Santa Cruz will do as well. So that's going to be at 7:30, hopefully. So you can certainly check that out here. And if you miss the show because you have to go off to do something else or you want to listen to something else, it is archived. It'll be archived at Huff Santa Cruz, HUFFSantaCruz.org, which is the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom website. Humanity for Homeless is another website, which really has got some great video on it. It's about a year out of date because the guy who's updating it is in ill health and struggling with all kinds of health problems that would have put me under long ago if I had to suffer what he was suffering. But in any case, the show is archived. You can check it out later. And you can call in. 427-3772 is the number. What I'm going to do first is just get directly into some street interviews, which I'm behind on. So some of these are a little older, although actually these are all I think, within the last week and a half. I think we're going to start with Sunday, a week ago Sunday, whereas so today is the 2nd of April. This, I think, was, March 21st or something like that. Not sure. And this was the weekend when Dennis Adams was serving people free food, as he always does every Sunday at 1 or 2 o'clock at the town clock. And sometimes when it's raining, he serves illegally under the eaves of the parking lot across from the bank between River and Front Streets. I think it's River and Front Streets. Anyway, you're going to hear me looking in on Curtis Relaford, who you may remember if you've been listening to this show regularly. He's an African-American activist who has been caravanning supplies to New Orleans, was defamed by a Starbucks employee for his truck and his trailer, which has big signs urging people to contribute to the Follow Your Heart Network, which I believe you can find online if you're interested. And they accused him of being a panhandler because he parked his truck legally in front of Starbucks on Pacific Avenue. He went to court with an inept lawyer, Jim King, and he was they essentially threw out the case. But the fact of the matter is a lot of people were concerned, and Curtis tried to have a public dialogue on that issue by setting up a lot of display signs downtown. That's where we join this particular interview, and I'll be talking more about it as we proceed, though. There's so many issues that come up that this one looks like it's kind of passing and will soon be gone, unless I hear some more actually happening. You might let me know if anybody knows whether the Starbucks downtown has ever actually apologized to Curtis, stated it will not ever again harass him or other charitable organizations for the crime of panhandling or falsely call the police on him or make false police reports. I don't know what they're doing. I haven't found out, but maybe somebody could find out. My off-air number, if you got information for me, tips, or you want to be on the air, or you want to denounce me privately or commend me privately, is 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. I am your host, Robert Norris, in case I didn't say so before. Anyway, let's hear from about a week and a half ago on Sunday, right there, kind of between Lulu Carpenter's and the Vets Hall in that area, which now is largely, it's criminal to set up display devices due to the new downtown ordinances, but that didn't stop Curtis. Good for him. Of course, it's always helpful to have a appropriate tape in when you're turning on the machine. We're going to try that one again.
That was Pastor Dennis Adams. And it's now about 2:30 at the town clock. Across the street, there's a whole setup by Curtis Relaford, who is going to New Orleans and back, just giving out supplies. He's got American flags up, big signs of peace, describing his Follow Your Heart Foundation. And over here at the town clock, we have a famous couple that are being interviewed by Becky Johnson, and we're on the front pages of yesterday's Sentinel, Miguel de Leon and Anna Richardson, who are being targeted for tickets. And Becky's talking to them.
He's this big progressive liberal. Now, he told me that the first person sighted...
So, actually, I think the Relaford description, which is actually happening at the same time, Curtis has this very large series of big wooden placards across the street and from the town clock right in the Veterans Memorial area in front of Jamba Juice. And I was actually kind of walking back and forth between this town clock where there was a collection of about 100 to 200 homeless people who were eating food at Dennis Adams' Sunday meal, and Curtis's really lone display. He was running back and forth trying to make sure the signs didn't fall down, trying to set up amplified sound, talking to the occasional person, but it was rather sad for me to see that very few people showed up, and perhaps more showed up after I left. I don't know. But anyway, here's Becky Johnson interviewing the couple at the town clock that has been the subject of a lot of discussion on the radio, even more in the Sentinel's bigot-scarred forums. In fact, it got so bad that an entire thread was removed from the online discussion of this of the article in the Sentinel about these two getting an injunction from the city attorney, who's trying to get this one passed through Judge Burdick. Looks like he will, unless a lot of people step up to the plate and support these two. These are a couple who are musicians who are homeless who have incurred up to 50 to 60 tickets for sleeping in the downtown area. And I want to make it real clear that I may have given a misimpression. They will not be criminalized for sleeping, period, although that's already a crime. So, yes, they are already criminalized, as is every other homeless person in Santa Cruz who's unable to get to a shelter. They can't. There's, you know, shelters cover 10 to 20% at most of homeless people, even those who choose or are able to get to those shelters, but it's illegal otherwise, and three unaddressed citations will result in a misdemeanor citation, according to the latest anti-homeless laws by John Barisonia and his Santa Cruz City Council. But this injunction actually is a step even further than that. This is attorney, this is City Attorney John Barisoni going on with a proposal to make it contempt of court for these two to go to sleep anywhere in the downtown area itself. And that's, it is limited to the downtown area, so presumably they could just get misdemeanor prosecutions if they go to sleep elsewhere in town, but they'll get an injunction, they'll get a contempt citation if this injunction is passed. However, we have a caller. Hi there, caller. You're on Free Radio.
Oh, hi, Robert. It's Craig.
Hey, Craig. What's up?
Well, I heard you talking about the comments on the Sentinel story. And the story is that, is I noticed you posted there, but you didn't register, did you? So when you log into Topics, you don't get a notice if there's responses to your messages, do you?
Well, actually, you know, I do in the sense that I get a so many new comments have appeared about your comments. So my comments actually were posted, and I do get notification if I go online. But I've noticed the entire comments section for the story about Miguel de Leon and Anna Richardson is gone. You can no longer access it. You can't.
No, it's still there, Robert.
Oh, really?
Let me tell you. Yeah, yeah. You have to. The only way you can find it. First, they moved it to Pasadena, and so then I sent them an email and said, "Why did you move this to Pasadena?" And of course, the reason is they're trying to bury the comments. And so then, when I sent them an email, then they moved it to San Gabriel. So this morning, I found it in San Gabriel. And
well, you are the detective there, Craig.
And I said, why did you move this to San Gabriel? And so they moved it back to Pasadena. So the last I looked, it was in Pasadena.
Well, you know, that's what you can do if you're interested is perhaps send me an email giving me details on this. I got to tell you, I don't know if it's really newsworthy for people who are listening to this show because, first of all, even though I think you have the occasional intelligent comment, or your comment is one of the few comments that I find worth reading. A lot of it's ad hominem attacks on Becky and these two people and the courts and, you know, homeless people generally. So I don't know that it's really something we want to talk about. And also it's something that most people don't have in front of their eyes, so they can't really see, you know, what we're talking about. So I would appreciate it if you'd, you know, maybe drop me an email that says, hey, Robert, go to the such and such a place if you want to find it. And, you know, I think
well,
some
Robert,
of the...
Robert, you said you know where it is, so I don't see the point in doing that. I called up because I thought I find that interesting. It's something that I noticed. I don't really have anything else to say.
Oh, well, okay, but, you know, call again if you'd like. And thank you for, you know, for that thought. I'm just, you know, I mentioned it, and I appreciate your, you know, kind of clarifying what's going on, although it's... I still will need a little... I'll need to look over your email if you send me an email on this issue to understand exactly what's cooking. But thank you. And Craig is often a prolific writer on his own right. He's been active in the medical marijuana movement for a long time, faced a lot of discrimination around that, both as a homeless person and a housed person. And he still continues to write on the issue and hopefully will continue to write. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Let's get back to, again, the interviews that were going on at the Town Clock about the Sunday before last. And take it from there. But feel free to call in if you've got some thoughts on any of this stuff.
Under the law was his own son, and sort of by accident, his son lived down in Harvey West Park and was sharing a house, a very small house, with a buddy of his. And his buddy had his girlfriend come to spend the night. So Bert Mealy's son went out and slept in the car in front of the house and got the first sleeping ban ticket issued in the city of Santa Cruz. And Bert wasn't very happy about it either. But
who was this again?
Bert Mealy.
The old mayor back in the 70s.
Yeah.
Son.
He'd also had a problem with some homeless guy he had.
And Lee's band is still playing.
Down a bit.
Looks like that conversation between Becky and the couple who are likely to be banned from Pacific Avenue with a court injunction for primarily for sleeping tickets that they haven't paid is going to go on. And right, we have a successful couple here that has not been hassled recently by the police.
No, we haven't. Why not? Aren't they good at harassing people? We found a good hiding spot, I suppose.
And what? And how long is since you had your last sleeping ticket?
About 2.5 months.
Very good. And again, your name so we can tell the police.
Zach Wise.
And
Ella Mae Wise.
And I know you two were part of the abortive sleeping ban lawsuit that has disappeared beneath the waves, but may rise again.
And I have, yeah. You're also present is.
And here's a man passing around a peace pipe, so to speak.
I was going to say, now hear this.
And there you do it. You can probably smell it if you were here.
Whoa. Relaxation local.
Thank you, David.
Smell race.
So I'm back here at the Follow Your Heart Network. Again, a lot of American flags around the Veterans Memorial sculpture. Walking about is Curtis in his signature black hat and black overcoat. A lot of signs. Now is the time for action. Here is the soapbox. Tell us what you stand for. Curtis, I recognize Frederick Douglass's picture, but who are these other two folks that I should recognize?
That guy who wrote down there, Booker T. Washington. And see that name right there?
Let's see. I'm looking closely. Lawrence Dunbar. Who was Lawrence Dunbar?
No.
We don't know. We're going to find out, though. I think we need W.E.B. Du Bois's picture up there, too. And how about some women, all these men? I'm going to have to accuse you of being a sexist pig soon. By the way, I hope you like the cranberry sauce on that. Sorry about that. So, Curtis is here, and he's kind of got this series of large wooden signs which kind of describe his mission, what he's up to. The purposes of this fundraiser are to raise money so I may return to Louisiana, repair my heavy-duty main truck and trailer and return them to Santa Cruz, take the remainder of the donated items to Louisiana. Thank you. And a phone number for Curtis is 246-4240, www.followyourheartactionnetwork.com. Curtis has also parked his controversial vehicle and trailer up the street, where apparently the meter maid, on being asked, has told him that he can't be there for more than an hour or they will ticket him. And Curtis, you're no stranger to tickets, right?
And actually, this is interesting because it's not a one-hour parking zone, then you have to move your vehicle. It is a parking zone with a meter, which I guess in a certain sense is the same thing, but in another sense, there was a big controversy around this issue with Corey McDonald, also known as Mr. Twister, some years back. He used to walk up and down the street, putting dimes, nickels, and I guess nowadays it would be quarters in the meters, right ahead of the meter maid, because he didn't like the city to be preying upon those who were, you know, parked a little too long, and they arrested him for violating the law that said you could only park for 1 hour, you can't put money in someone else's meter, or whatever. So I find it a little peculiar that Curtis is being told he can't park there if he continues to feed the meter. I suppose technically speaking that's true in a certain sense, but I've never had any problem. I've been feeding meters all my life. My car is very distinctive. I've never gotten a citation for it. Curtis is African American. His vehicles are even more distinctive than mine. I've got a car covered with bumper stickers. He's got a large truck and even in a large trailer, which take up a total of about 2 parking spaces. You know, which advertises charitable activities, I think properly so. I think, you know, we have far too much advertising of corporate nonsense and useless overconsumption and too little for the kind of stuff Curtis is doing. You know, I've had the occasional criticism of, you know, what about the poor here in Santa Cruz, Curtis? You know, I had to mention that. You know, it's nice to go to New Orleans, but, you know, how about the people who are getting harassed on Pacific Avenue? But, you know, he's expressed some solidarity recently around that issue. In fact, he got caught up in the whole panhandling paranoia. He was given this, they claimed, you're a panhandler, and the Sentinel reported this false charge and the false claim that he was engaged in breaking the law. At least that's what the manager at Starbucks reportedly said, according to Curtis's friends' report of the police officers who spoke to him that day a year and a half ago, in, I guess, the fall of 2007. Anyway, here's more from the street. A week ago Sunday.
He's had a ticket or two in his life, and he can't afford that because he's got other things to do with his money, and other people can use it better probably than the city's parking fund. Anyway, it's very windy. You probably can't even hear what I'm saying on this machine, but hey, Curtis is here. He is responding to, trying to encourage the community to proceed to be aware of what he's up to and donate if they wish. So that's what's happening. And we'll leave it at that for the moment. This is a one-man band here. He's putting up signs that the wind is blowing over.
The sign here says, walk your truth, seek your walk your talk, seek your truth, be your journey. There are four kinds of people: those who say what should happen, those who watch what happens, those who say what happened, and there are those who make it happen. Which are you? And passersby walking by have been picking up the signs as the wind blows them down. But it is a windy day, and Curtis is on a kind of a lonely vigil here. Across the street about an hour ago, there were, I would say, 100, 150 people at the Dennis Adams meal. You heard that earlier on the tape. And, of course, folks are checking out Curtis's display. What do you think of the display here for Free Radio Santa Cruz?
I think it's fantastic. I think this is a type of step we need to be making here to stand tall as Americans and take back our democracy.
It's interesting. You realize this entire display is illegal under Santa Cruz ordinances.
Interesting that...
I don't know how stupid the ordinances are, but...
Interesting that standing up for your rights is illegal.
Yeah, it's illegal to lean a sign against public property. It's illegal to have amplified sound equipment without a permit. It's illegal to have a display device within 14 feet of a sculpture. That's a new law the downtown city council passed.
Actually, that's within 10 feet, I believe, of a sculpture. But I'll double check that.
Downtown Association merchants behind it. But I'm glad to see some people are proceeding to be expressing their feelings and messages regardless of ridiculous codes that cities pass.
Yeah, I think this is definitely a step in the right direction. We got to bring it back to the people, because it's all about the democracy. People got scared away from, you know, being a part of the democracy, and we start to think that we're in some other sort of government. But the truth is, we are the government here in America, and we need to take it back.
I agree with you. What is your name, citizen?
Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan. This will be on Free Radio probably Thursday evening.
Cool.
So I'm here in front of Verizon, where there's only one bench where there used to be four. One directly in front of Verizon, one facing it slightly up the street toward Artisans, and then two more benches facing each other in front of Gala Cabana. And the guitarist you're hearing in the background was here years ago. He remembers those benches, but he's a very want to be interviewed at this time. Plus, you wouldn't be able to hear him because of the wind. But he's got a great voice, and you can hear this little soft in the background, or you could if you were on your toes. And we have the great Morgami playing in yellow confetti. Again, it is stand in front of the Dale Williams, actually on Dale Williams' property. In case I haven't said so before, there's a police car actually kind of half parked in, half parked out of a parking place here. I'm not sure what it's doing here. It's kind of half blocking traffic and half letting it go. The police car could park in the parking spot, but for some reason has chosen not to. The date today is March 22nd, 2009. And maybe his cop has rushed in for a cup of coffee. That could be. But if he had, why wouldn't he park his vehicle? He's coming back to his squad car, to squad car number 16. And he's entering the car. And it's about 5 to 3 in the afternoon. Still sunny. It was rainy earlier. And this police car is mercifully pulling away. And the entire area around the Walnut Avenue, Pacific Avenue planter, where the pendulum is, the Vanderkerkhove's pendulum, which is the subject of controversy because it seems to be selectively enforced if people push it. I have to confess, I pushed it last night, or the night before as I walked past. Actually, it was last night, I believe. I didn't violate any laws, though. It's not actually illegal to push the pendulum if you don't walk onto the property to do so. Actually, so I will find out one way or another.
And that is public property that it's illegal to walk onto. These are the fenced-off areas, these huge planter areas. Used to be you could sit on the edges or ledge of the planter. the Pacific Trading Company and the Redevelopment Agency and the Police Department colluded in 2003 to move the railing of the fence over to eliminate the seating area because they didn't like the musicians sitting there. They were quite candid about that. And we did some protesting around it. There was actually a number of arrests. They arrested us under the "you must move your display device every hour." We said, no, we're actually encouraging people not to patronize the Pacific Trading Company. This was back in 2003. Anyway, the pendulum issue is coming up in court, I believe, in mid-April, because Lather, a homeless person, pushed the pendulum after a couple of tourists did, a couple of tourist kids did, and the cop took off after Lather and gave him a citation while ignoring what the other folks did. We'll see how that turns out.
Property being, of course, one would think it's public property, one would think it's city property, but it's actually belongs to the merchants, the police, and the city staff, who apparently have the only license to enter that property, even though it was purchased with public money. It's in the middle of the public space, and it's not damaging in any way to go in there. These are the large planter areas where once it was legal to sit on the edge of the planter, but gradually that public space has been taken away. So now there are only only one planter left, the planter near where we heard Curtis Relaford and here, Jamba Juice and Lulu Carpenter's, and the post office is now also illegal to sit within 14 feet of. And in front of Borders Bookstore, there is one lone bench left of all the benches that were here before. But perhaps the benches will be put back again.
I may be wrong about that issue, about the seating area next to Jamba Juice down at the end of the mall across from the post office and Lulu Carpenter's. Because if there is an actual seating area, if there's a bench area that is kind of built into the planter, that may be regarded as a place you can sit. And I'm going to have to look up that over more closely. So I don't want to be accused of exaggerating, but it certainly has to be said that seating space is at a premium downtown because the merchants want to make sure that as few, quote, undesirable characters as they can have any place to be in the, or maybe if you want to put it more charitably, they want to be given smaller spaces that will provide broader avenues for the right kind of people. You know, shoppers and people who drink cappuccinos and that sort of thing.
This will allow the city to make sure people don't sit down within 14 feet of the bench. Ah, but they won't be because there's already a no-sitting zone there because of the change-making machine that was set up there, probably with that very purpose in mind. Also missing is the bench at Walnut and Pacific along Walnut next to the corner World Market Bazaar store where the famous CJ Stock bench. So benches are at a premium downtown, and I see hosts walking up and down, but only one sign of a police officer, and that was the double parked car mentioned earlier. Illegally parked car. Well, a police officer would say it's not illegal because the policeman is doing it. So here in front of O'Neill's, across the street from the Cinema 9, we find a man with a sign. Please help with a few bucks or some food. Thank you. He's having another man. It's actually his former Barefoot Brad, who is one of the only actually along Pacific Avenue where it's legal to sit within 14 feet of a sculpture or record sign. It's actually more than 14 feet of a sculpture, so I'll have to leave this man here with us.
This is becoming increasingly hard to hear, so let's take a vacation from this one. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert. The name of the show is Bathroom Spears Broadsides, and the call-in number is 427-3772, in case you want to call in. A couple of updates here. Here's a letter from Curly Estramiris. For those of you who follow the show regularly, Curly was You may remember Curley was assaulted by police in Hayward after coming back from a demonstration supporting Oscar Grant III, the guy who was executed by a BART police officer in a BART station, face down as he was restrained with a bullet in the back of his head, or perhaps his neck, I don't know. And Curley got falsely arrested, seriously roughed up, denied medication, abusively treated by medical authorities, and I think after a really a nightmare night, released. He posts a story about it on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, which you can read. His name again is Curley Estramirez, in case you want to hear it. But his most recent post reads as follows: "Dear brothers, I have to apologize for the silence, but I've been in grief over the death of brother Richard Aki, which by now, do you know, how did he pass on March the 15th? I knew and loved him well. I'm enclosing a written answer to the so-called internal affairs assholes in Hayward, which is Hayward, which is the last happening in my case. I have filed a $108,000 city claim with the city of Hayward for starters. The problem has been that I've been unable to find an attorney with the guts to file a multimillion lawsuit with these traducers. Perhaps you all have some contacts on that end. In the meantime, I will be free to speak either on the radio or live if you need me to. Onward, Curley." More locally, I recently saw both on Indie Bay, but unfortunately not as a top story. So you couldn't. Most people, I think, looking on Indie Bay, I don't know what most people do, but I know I and others, certainly a few other people, normally we look at the main stories on this Santa Cruz Indie Media website that are in the center of the website. They usually have pictures, sometimes some video, sometimes some audio. And then on the side, the right-hand side, there's a series of recent updated stories I often post there. If you go all the way down to the bottom on the right, which is kind of the burial ground of stories, you find where Indie Bay puts stories it calls other, or even breaking stories that they have not chosen to put on the top. And one of those stories is a letter from a Cabrillo College guy, a student, who writes the following. Let's see if I can find it here. I had it a moment ago. It's rather shocking. And it's headed, titled, "Cabrillo College Police State" by Steve Jones. And it reads as follows: "America's fascist police state has reared its ugly head here at Cabrillo College. My fellow students and faculty members, you are now required to log in and or show ID and have your name recorded in order to see the Internet at our library. This is a sharp departure from when the Internet was free and open to anyone who wished to use it at the library, particularly non-students and general members of the community. The new policy sets up an illegal police state spy and surveillance grid that can track, monitor, control, and restrict our use of the Internet. This is direct violation of our cherished constitutional Fourth Amendment rights to privacy, since username and password accounts record the user website viewing history, email content, and a whole slew of other variables that those who run the computer networks will now have access to. Like the illegal U.S. Department of Homeland Security-funded spy and surveillance cameras that have recently metastasized on our street light intersections these past 8 long years, I'm not familiar with any connection between Homeland Security and stoplight cameras that, you know, put your picture down if you go through the light, go through a red light, but it could well be happening. Police state spying and surveillance of Internet use has now reared its ugly head into educational academic domain where it doesn't belong. Free and open access to the global information superhighway known as the Internet is the very reason why institutions such as Cabrillo College exist in the first place. If we abrogate our responsibility to not participate in illegal police state spying on our campus and submit to a policy that blatantly disregards our fundamental Fourth Amendment right to privacy, we might as well be living in Soviet Russia, Communist China, or, God forbid, Nazi Germany. Do we really want to live in a tyrannical dictatorship that has knowledge of everything we do and say on the Internet? I think not. As well, let's not give them the ability to do this. The Internet does not belong to police state spy and surveillance agencies. It belongs to us, the people. Contact Johanna Bowen, the director of the Cabrillo College Library, to voice your outrage. That's J-O Bowen, J-O-B-O-W-E-N, at Cabrillo, that's C-A-B-R-I-L-L-O, Cabrillo, .edu, J-O-B-O-W-E-N, J-O Bowen, info@cabrillo.edu. Contact also Renee Kilmer, Vice President of Instruction, R.E. Kilmer, K-I-L-M-E-R, at cabrillo.edu, and Brian King, the President of Cabrillo College, at brian.king@cabrillo.edu, to demand that this new mandatory login policy at our library be immediately rescinded with formal apologies issued. Contact the Cabrillo College Student Senate, sign the no login petition at the Student Services Center, and let's say no to the mandatory logins on our campus now and forever. Lastly, do not condone this new library policy by participating, setting up, and using an account. Let us boycott the use of the library computers until the police state assault on our freedoms and liberties are ended permanently and the Internet is returned back to the students where it belongs. Signed, Steve Jones, Cabrillo College student returning and Cabrillo College alumnus. And in the follow-up to that whole thing, there is another letter from Steve Jones. Cabrillo College, as of 4-2, that's today, has suspended me, a student and an alumnus, for standing up against the fascist Nazi police state that has unfortunately taken over the college. This has taken the form of U.S. Department of Homeland Security illegal spying and surveillance of students' computer use at the college library via a new mandatory login policy put into practice as of January 15th of this year. My challenge is obviously a threat to the powers that be. Three women who work or have worked at the college, one is suspect, is an undercover military police state officer, have simultaneously come against me for specious, false, and outrageous threat reasons, all trumped up and designed to come against and discredit me for the grievance I submitted to the college attempting to expose and end the illegal police state spying and surveillance. As a Muslim, I believe also that I am being discriminated against for religious reasons. I had similarly filed a religious discrimination complaint against the college over another issue, a health waiver fee, but it seems the discrimination is systematic, so I may have to file another religious grievance complaint over the recent suspension, which I consider an act of violence and completely unwarranted, as well as a form of retribution against me for my original grievance. Steve Jones, Cabrillo College student. Now, I actually wrote an email back to Steve Jones, inviting him to come on the show and talk. I haven't contacted any of these other people who he is complaining about, nor have I gotten any further information about the Cabrillo College stuff, the Cabrillo College policy of requiring logins as of January 15th. So, if anybody knows anything about this, please let me know. Give a call to 423-HUFF. 423-4833, that's my off-air number, 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F, or call my online, 427-3772, if you'd like. That's something you can do right now. And you'll give have the added bonus of giving listeners an opportunity to hear some other voice than mine. In fact, why don't we do that right now with a little music? Let's have a little musical break here and throw a little more of Pedro, Pablo, and Maria. How does that sound?
Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to clay. Just give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comforting glow of a wood fire. But please take all of your atomic poison power away. Everybody needs some power, I'm told, shield them from the darkness and the cold.
Some may see a way to take control when it's bought and sold.
I know that lives are at stake, yours and mine and our descendants of time. There's so much to gain, so much to lose. Every one of us has a choice. Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to clay.
it can be. The limits of the ways that can define every cross that lies. Some don't even care, we know that will pay. But we have seen the face of death in our day. There's a little time to change our ways. If only we together can say, just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things, they return to play. Just give me the restless power of the wind.
And there you are, still relevant as the nuclear industry tries to ram its nuclear power down our throats. Interesting stuff on Democracy Now! In the last few days. Amy Goodman had a Harvey Wasserman interview. Harvey's been a long-time opponent of nuclear power, particularly the huge bailout and financing that the government gives the nuclear power industry. Let's continue with my bench report downtown from a week ago Sunday. Hey, you need to know what's going on with those benches, particularly if you get tired. You know, you want to sit down. You don't want to sit down illegally, and you don't want to have to spend money in a cafe. So what do? Well, look for a bench. But make sure you have your watch with you, because you can't be there for more than an hour. You know that. So keep that in mind and try to be legal, everybody.
Down here in front of Byzantine Jewelry, across from American Apparel, Chef Works, there are still pairs of benches that are actually facing each other. Zachary's, of course, is still has its open-air cafe, which is okay if you have money. And we're purchasing at Zachary's. And still parked here at 305 is Curtis Relaford's Follow Your Heart Action Network trailer and white pickup truck. Getting a lot of photos from different folks, but he alone is managing this display, so his supporters don't seem in evidence. Right, we have a man who's got a way with words. Your name, sir?
Lyrical Eye.
Go ahead, Lyrical Eye. What you got to say for us?
All right. Poverty is destroying the USA, eating at our population like an unchecked epidemic. Do you know shanty houses with outhouses still exist in America? Uneducated children being left to drop out in America? Neglected, never giving opportunity or chance to live a simple life in America. Instead, they're brutalized, victimized, humiliated, exploited, denied even basic leisure and memories. Robbing the individuality consequently kept in the watchful eyes of the powers that be. It's just being human is differently. It's some shameful crime of living in America.
Thank you, Lyrical Eye. So we have a police station wagon which is pausing to observe you guys in front of Rush Inn. Daniel, what's going on here? I see you have a sign and a walking cane. What does it say?
It's a hitchhiking sign. North 101, please, do you have room for one more?
But you weren't flying that sign.
No.
And what is your name, you, Mr. Criminal?
My name is Evan.
And Evan, you're packing up your backpack. Why is that?
Because we were sitting on the curb and the police officer came and told us that we had to move.
Sitting on the curb is now a crime, eh?
Sitting on the curb, well, I was kind of laying in the other one.
Laying on the curb.
Well, kind of half laying, half sitting.
Half sitting and half laying. But
leaning up against my backpack.
Well, the police are leaving. It looks like you've corrected your
Indeed, we have.
Yes.
Yes, we've made the world a better place by getting ourselves off the curb.
Well, you're really causing a great consternation in the Rush Inn. They're probably very concerned about your behavior.
Yeah, there's all kinds of people rushing in, as you can see.
Indeed. It's kind of hard to avoid all of them.
Yeah, no, there's
wherever they may be.
There's absolutely no traffic or no people or nothing right here on the street whatsoever. But, you know, know that's what the cops do, is they tell you to stop sitting or laying or walking or standing or whatever it might be that you're doing, and they tell you to move on.
It's all good exercise, yeah?
Yeah, well, it just seems to be the motion of the flow of how they want society. They don't want you to be somewhere. They want you to keep on moving. You know, being somewhere seems to be the problem.
Well, unless you're paying rent, perhaps you'd better keep going.
Well, we thought the other night about putting some quarters in the parking meter and camping out right there and seeing if, since we'd paid for the
camping
parking
is illegal in Santa Cruz, except in the non-existent campgrounds.
Indeed, it is. So it kind of makes sleeping hard for those who are...
Sleeping is illegal in Santa Cruz at night, but you can sleep during the day from 8:30 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Oh, so we should all become nocturnal.
Provided you are not lying down in the downtown area.
Not lying down in the downtown area, so we should all become nocturnal.
In the outside downtown area.
In the outside downtown area.
Well, you've got to be pretty careful because, after all, we are in the middle of a terrorist alert. As you may remember, there was 9/11, and I mean, things are pretty bad.
Indeed. As far as I can tell, kind of street kids and home bums and that sort of stuff have never quite been terrorists. The type that would, run airplanes into buildings.
Well,
anyway.
Let's look at it this way. They are being terrified by the police department, which is just practicing so that in case terrorists show up, they will be able to be terrified by the police department.
Indeed. I mean, what's happening is that, humanity is changing from one epoch to another. One way of life is changing into yet again another way of life. And we're sort of in the transition phase right here. So you're going to get a lot of backlash from people who want to keep the old way and see it slipping out the door, wilts the new way kind of tidal waves itself over it. But since transition is never easy, death, life into death, death into life, sober into tripping. It's always the transition part that's hard. So right now society is kind of in this transition phase.
You are a sociologist of sorts, of the streets, perhaps.
I'm just a traveler,
You're a traveling talker, it sounds like.
Traveling talker, well, it depends.
Or a talking traveler.
Talking traveler, I could be that.
Well, of both, yes. We've been talking with...
Evan...
Thank you, Evan. And may your journey be a meaningful one. As they say, it is not the end, but it is rather the journey itself.
Indeed, and I really appreciate that, and I appreciate what you're doing out there, and I hope that you keep up the good work, and let's hope that the transition goes smoothly as things start to kick into gear. But, here we are.
Remember,
at
the homeless person in the grave is less expensive than a homeless person on the avenue.
Oh, I know. And in jail, I don't know, are they making money from that or something? I don't know what the deal is. But, having us all three days.
We only have the good sense to, shall we say, disappear and keep a very low profile, possibly 10 miles off the road.
Well, if there's a spot for us to go, I think we'd all go there.
We'll try and find a place for you.
Sounds like the answer.
Thank you, Evan.
Okay, thank you. All you right. Have a good day.
What's your name, madam?
Oh, hi, I'm Becky.
Now, Becky, you are an old-time homeless activist, a fearless crusader for the rights of the Israeli government, as some would say. But you're also a person who's developed your own blog, yes?
Oh, this is very nascent.
Please use words that ordinary individuals can understand.
I guess it was March 17th. My older sister encouraged me to start a blog because I've been having some problems with... Santa Cruz Indie Media and IndieBay.org.
Censorship problem?
Yeah, censorship and malicious attacks. And
what about the ever-lovable Sentinel website where you are seen to post at least 15 times a day?
Well, yeah, I thought, well, why give it away? I can put it in a blog and then it's mine.
Might even get some advertising revenue from it.
That's a possibility up the road. Right now, I'm just trying to collect some of my writings in one place and have a more control over that.
And we're listening to activist Becky Johnson, who has written probably more on homeless issues than almost anybody in Santa Cruz, perhaps except me. I've probably been writing longer than she has, but she writes a lot. And she spends a lot of time trying to correct the misimpressions of those who are hostile to street people downtown, homeless people in other areas of town, activists who support them, who leave their comments at the end of the stories that the Santa Cruz Sentinel has on its website. And Becky spends a lot of time doing this. I think that's what Craig Canada called in about earlier. He was talking about, our earlier caller spoke about how you can, the thread has not disappeared. The comment thread is still around. You have to search for it, though perhaps I will, and perhaps he'll assist me in that, although why one would want to search for a Sentinel thread thread is, I don't know. Why I'd even talk about it here is a mystery. I've got a couple of stories here I'd like to kind of pass on before I get into the actual interview time with the two activists from, we're talking about the Fresno homeless situation, which will be coming up at 7:30 or before. That's going to be Mike Rhodes of Fresno and Jeremy Alderson of the Homelessness Marathon, who's kind of, he goes all around the country, and we're going to be looking at or listening to that debate. A couple of things have come in, though, that might be of interest to folks. You may remember Jim Gottstein, who is an attorney who is concerned with the rights of people faced with forced psychiatric drugging. And he has written, he's got a press release here, which he sent to me. Alaska admits it is incapable of protecting children and youth in its care from harmful psychiatric drugging. And it's Dateline March 31st, today, responding to the state of Alaska's admission to Psych Rights versus Alaska, that's a lawsuit he filed, that it was incapable of protecting the children and youth in its care from improper and harmful psychiatric drugging. The Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, or Psych Rights, told the court it must step in. Psych Rights versus Alaska was filed last fall to halt the state of Alaska's practice of administering and paying for psychiatric drugs being given to children and youth without safeguards being in place to make sure proper decision-making occurs. In trying to get Psych Rights versus Alaska thrown out of court, the state of Alaska admitted it was incapable of protecting the children and youth in its care by saying the following. And they said, a reading of the complaint makes it obvious that the true subject of the plaintiff's grievances is not the department, the Alaska government, but prescribers of psychotropic pharmaceuticals, the pharmaceutical companies which produce and market them, and the overall culture of pediatric psychiatry. The implication that the department possesses meaningful authority and control over these matters, or is in any realistic position to administer the relief requested, even if the court were to order it, is a fiction. In other words, the state of Alaska is saying, we can't do anything because it's all in the hands of the pharmaceutical companies. That's an interesting response to the claim that they should be advising parents about what the real dangers of these pharmaceutical drugs are and prescribing less dangerous alternatives as possibilities, or at least making them aware of those prospects. Gottstein, the attorney involved and the activist with Psych Rights, continues, the point is the state has the responsibility to properly care for the children and youth in its care, regardless of the, quote, culture of psychiatric psychiatry. Today's court filing tells the court it is shameful the state is abdicating its responsibility when it should be working to correct the problem. In the absence of the state being willing to address the problem without court intervention, the lawsuit by the by Gottstein's group, Psych Rights, seeks to solve it by obtaining a court order prohibiting the psychiatric drugging of children and youth by the state unless and until, one, evidence-based psychosocial interventions have been exhausted, two, rationally anticipated benefits of psychotropic drug treatment outweigh the risks, three, the person or entity authorizing administration of the drugs is fully informed of the risks and potential benefits, that's the parent or guardian, I would assume, four, close monitoring of and appropriate means of responding to treatment emergency effects are in place. Practically every day brings revelations that pediatric psychopharmacology is the result of illegal drug company actions to improperly influence psychiatrists to prescribe extremely harmful drugs to children and youth, in spite of there being no real evidence of their efficacy. Quote, rather than meeting its mandate to properly care for and protect these children and youth from harm, the actions of the state are reprehensible, Mr. Gottstein declared, adding, the state is also trying to hide its complicity by stopping the discovery process, which means if they're looking for documents from the pharmaceutical industries in the state to show either they are trying to protect children and get full information or they're not, and the state is opposing the release of these documents. So that's up in Alaska. Here's another story by Park Burgess called Zen, Busking, and Anarchy, with a tip of the hat to Tom Noddy, our own bubble-blowing performer and sometimes Street Performers Guild guidelines originator of almost 30 years ago, who apparently is now interested in what's going on in Santa Cruz and may make a reappearance soon. That's what I hear from Brent Adams, the drummer. Anyway, Park Burgess writes, "When I play the Bach suites for cello on city streets, I am acutely aware of both my freedom and yours. Music making becomes my meditation. My spontaneous response to the music flows freely, and I offer that experience to you, the listener. You have the freedom to respond any way you like. We have no contractual agreement. You can toss a coin into my case or not. And it makes no difference. I make no effort to control you, and you, I hope, make no effort to control me. This is deeply subversive, even anarchistic. Although I am playing respectable music, my intent runs directly counter to the compliant mentality that our culture demands of us and constantly woos us to accept. Most people think of anarchy as all hell breaking loose. But what anarchy really means is a society without hierarchies of power." We have a caller. I will interrupt my reading because callers come first. Hi, you're on Free Radio, caller. What's your name?
Hey, it's Dave.
Drummer Dave?
Hey.
Are you Drummer Dave?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Drummer Dave, what's
Santa
the word?
Cruz, what's going on?
Well, now calm down, Dave. What's your report for me today?
Oh, well, Food Not Bombs came by yesterday. Man, they had some pizza that was killer, man.
Down there
at the Drum Circle by the farmer's market there.
Well, you know, I was wandering around the Drum Circle. I'll be playing that tape probably in a year and a half, given the backlog of tapes I have. But
yeah, I've been hearing that backlog. Wow. That's a plenty big backlog you got there, Rob.
It's true. It's true.
I like hearing about Curtis, though.
Oh, Curtis Relaford. Yeah, I haven't heard much from him. I haven't heard any follow-up. I know there was a group on police abuse that supposedly met a week or two ago, but I haven't heard anything from them. So far, the silence seems to be the word, unfortunately.
Yeah, but I miss those benches on the mall, man. I need a place to sit down, man. I used to have an old lady. She had to sit down every 10 feet, man. She couldn't go too far, too fast, you know?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, hey, we need those benches back, man. Where are they? What are they doing? They're keeping them for carnival rides at the boardwalk?
Say that again?
I said, are they using those at the boardwalk on the carnival rides?
You know, I think the benches may have been, you know, I think they've been put into storage for a better time. And who knows?
Hey, you know, we need Pacific Avenue, you know, boardwalk rides, you know, on the benches. You know, we used to be able to ride them down there.
Well, the police will give you a special ride, Drummer Dave, if you stay on the bench for more than an hour. So look at it.
Look, those parking meters are uncomfortable, man. They got this tip on them, man. It gets hard, man. You know, you can put the quarters in, but you can't sit on that thing too long. It gets hard to sit on.
Well, you know, I'm up for returning benches, although, of course, the danger with returned benches, as former mayor and council member Don Lane pointed out, is that it's now illegal. It's now illegal.
He needs to sit on a parking meter.
It's now illegal to
speak.
It's illegal to sit within 14 feet of a bench.
Well, who are these people? You're talking about they reside in a building in downtown Santa Cruz somewhere, a big concrete structure that looks like a big bench.
You know, I can't tell you, Drummer Dave. In fact, I'm having trouble understanding what the hell you're talking about, but I'm going to work on it.
Well, I'm talking about that building. It looks like a big park bench. It's right there at Ocean and Water.
Oh, you're talking about maybe the courthouse or maybe the...
is that what that is? It's
yeah,
bench,
that's probably
right?
What that is.
That's
where you'll be going when you
right?
continue your questionable behavior there.
Where they actually let you sit
there,
down.
Dave. Well, Dave, I want to thank you for your usual pungent.
Look, you actually have to let me sit down on Pacific Garden Mall.
I got to be careful because I'm even allowing you on the air to say these things may put my non-license in jeopardy.
Well, I really feel. You have credentials, sir. You have the best credential in the world. So you take it easy, Rob North, and I'll see you. And, hey, I know you appreciate historic preservation.
And hysterical preservation as well, but not preservation of hysterics like at the city council.
Yes, I wish they'd get more historic down there and provide benches for people on Pacific Garden Mall.
More historic, less hysteric. I agree. Thank you very much.
Hey, take care, Rob.
All right, man. Bye-bye. And we're entering our second hour of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Thank you, drummer Dave, for your call in. I would just love it if you actually had some new information to give us rather than your colorful commentary. But nonetheless, I tip my hat to you, or if I had a hat, I would tip it. Or perhaps I wouldn't, but I would say I was. Anyway, again, we'll be hearing from Mike Rose and Jeremy Alderson soon. However, in the studio with us, recovering from a recent surgery, is probably pain-encrusted Linda LeMaster, who's looking a little weary, but how you doing, Linda?
Hi, Robert. It didn't turn out to need surgery. I think it was just a chain of command to shuck the liability. I ended up with a fresh bandage.
Oh, see. So in other words,
I was told not to let anything touch my left hand.
You have a finger problem. You're giving me the finger. You got your finger, your left hand.
It's my ring finger.
Your ring finger.
Unfortunately, another metaphor.
It's all wrapped up in a bandage with a, looks like a brace. But you know, the reason that I often call you into the studio is because of your expertise on, and perhaps you'll find this interesting, because in about 25 minutes, I'm expecting, as I say, phone calls from two people who are actually grappling with the moguls of homelessness power, I should say, the poverty pimps, the big-time poverty pimps in America, who will be doling out millions of dollars to cities, supposedly to deal with the 10-year plan to babble about ending homelessness, which you actually have been involved with, the continuum of carelessness, I believe it was called, right?
The continuum of care is the government's moniker for this collaboration and is potentially a conduit to get some federal government money into the state of California and the county of Santa Cruz and other places. Yeah, I've been sort of involved with it. I've been part of that coalition for what? Well, since the end of the Homeless Issues Task Force, I started going to those meetings regularly then.
1999, 2000 was, you were a chair of that city council created body, which actually came up with a lot of good resolutions, but very few.
10 years.
Well, almost 9 years, perhaps. Long time, and it does seem to have passed very, very quickly. I was actually reading from a story about anarchy on the, street performing and what it means both as a meditation and as a kind of a form of mutual sharing, where it's kind of a subversive behavior because you aren't demanding anything from people and they aren't demanding anything from you, but you're kind of appreciating each other in a way that's directly at odds with the consumer society and the whole kind of compulsory system of paying rents and having to meet schedules. And this is something that's a little different. I was going to read a little bit more about this. I wanted to get your impression. Maybe you can listen to it and give me your thoughts.
I'm very interested, Robert. Thank you.
Yeah, this is deeply subversive, writes the writer. And again, we're reading the article, which is called Zen Busking, which busking means like playing music or performing on the streets, and Anarchy by Park Burgess. You have the freedom to respond any way you like. We have no contractual agreement. You can toss a coin into my case or not, and it makes no difference. I make no effort to control you, and you, I hope, make no effort to control me. This is deeply subversive, even anarchistic. Although I am playing respectable music, my intent runs directly counter to the compliant mentality that our culture demands of us and certainly woos us to accept. Most people think of anarchy as all hell breaking loose, but what anarchy really means is a society without hierarchies of power. Critics of anarchism argue that there are these two notions amount to the same thing, that hierarchies of power, and principally the state, maintain law and order. Anarchy, they say, leads to lawlessness and chaos. But, in fact, power hierarchies themselves have proven to be exceptionally violent over the long course of history. The state is simply the institutionalization of all hell breaking loose around a particular arrangement of power. Playing music on the street, even snooty music like the stuff I play, resonates mightily with the subversive tone of Zen anarchism. It calls us to feel what we feel and to express what we are and to be real to ourselves and to one another. When the use of power is primarily self-centered and largely unexamined, as it is in our society, the logic of might makes right prevails, and society becomes formalized around systems and practices that benefit the powerful at the expense of the weak. The promise of anarchism is that we might rise to the challenge of becoming transparent about our uses of power, intentional about sharing power in a more just way, and thoughtful about the corresponding organization of systems and structures. Only when we're deeply honest with ourselves, first of all, can we really discern the subtle and myriad ways we exercise power and try to control the world. Misery arises when we try to control others. Zen and anarchism converge on this point. The practice of Zen cultivates a freedom and openness of mind that promotes self-honesty and compassion. Anarchism provides a freedom and openness of social forms through which honesty and compassion may infuse our politics and economy and so become truly lived in the world. Thus, what we normally call Zen may be described as an anarchism of the mind, and what we normally call anarchism may be understood as a Zen of social relations. Playing music on the street, even snooty music, like the stuff I play, resonates mightily with the subversive tone of anarchism. Again, it calls us to feel what we feel, to express what we are, and to be real to ourselves and to one another. And that, friends, carries within it the seeds of a radically different and much greater society. This is by Park Burgess, wrote this article as a part of a Liberate Your Space, winter 2008 issue of Yes Magazine. So there, what do you think there, Linda?
Oh, I think he's got a good start on this topic. I think if you're going to talk about anarchy, the personal responsibility needs to be emphasized more than the misconceptions people already preconceive that I believe are part of the cartel. This writer's calling government, but the power establishment, the power elite. So anarchy really is a very profound and deeper than we're used to being allowed to be way of taking more responsibility. You fix your own potholes in anarchy, you know?
Well, I think the point he's got is, I hear you. I like his phrase about the society without hierarchies of power, and dealing with the fact
yes.
that the current, you know, all hell but breaking loose, and the violence really is we got the institutionalization of the people who currently own everything anyway, and who are who have made a mess of our economy and are continuing to, you know, get paid to do more of the same by the Obama regime.
Can I ask a question?
I suppose.
Robert, do you think there is more violence in a situation where this anarchy, or what passes for anarchy here, occurs than there is in the regimentation of the state as we know it?
Well, obviously he's saying no, not according to what he suggests.
I think it's more violent. I think you can just look at the population in the jails in California compared to the whole population. I think the state is more violent. Mm. They're just, you know, they're selectively violent, like the selective camping ban, you know?
I don't think anarchism is violent at all, really. Although anarchists in resisting the violence of the state sometimes use self-defense, and that is seen as violent because it's if somebody invades your house, you shoot back, or you
sound like Malcolm X right there.
Well, indeed.
I think that men need to express themselves fully, including with their bodies, and they're being prevented from it because of the rigidification and the soullessness that this state order that we bow to and pay taxes to has demanded of us.
Here's another story, ACLU funeral law. This is from Michigan, the Michigan Funeral Protest Law and Constitutional. This is by David Egbert from the AP. Lansing, Michigan, a lawsuit challenging Michigan's law restricting funeral protests was filed Wednesday on behalf of a couple who were pulled over and arrested during a procession for a friend killed in Iraq because their van bore signs critical of then-President George W. Bush. The ACLU says the 2006 state law is unconstitutional. It was approved with bipartisan support in response, this is interesting, to an anti-gay church that had protested at funerals of U.S. soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, presumably gay soldiers. And this was saying, you know, these guys were saying, you know, these gay people should all die. We're glad they're dead. And so they passed laws criminalizing protests at funerals. And, of course, the law was immediately used against people who were criticizing the government, you know, which shows you the danger of those kinds of laws. Although the legislature may have had honorable motives in passing the law, This case is a textbook example of what happens when the state gives police officers unchecked power to arrest people who express unpopular views, said Michael Steinberg, legal director for the ACLU of Michigan. The ACLU filed the federal lawsuit in Bay City against Clare County and two sheriff's deputies on behalf of a 64-year-old Army vet, Lewis Loudon, and his late wife, Jean. They were arrested in September 2007 in Harrison, about 140 miles northwest of Detroit, on their way to a burial of Army Corporal Todd Motley, 23, of Clare, who died in Mugdaya of wounds suffered when a bomb exploded near his vehicle during combat. The suit, which seeks unspecified damages from the county, says the Lowndes were close family friends. Gene Lowndes homeschooled Motley in high school, and Lewis Loudon took him on fishing and camping trips. Lewis Loudon, for years, had taped homemade political signs to the inside windows of his van criticizing the president and government policies. The lawsuit said they made statements such as impeach Cheney Bush, because we want to update that, it's now impeach Biden Obama, and G.W. Bush, the reason why Murphy wrote his law, or Obama, the reason why there are troops in Afghanistan and growing. No one complained about the signs when the Loudons arrived for the funeral, according to the suit, but during the funeral procession, viewed by hundreds of onlookers, the Loudons were pulled over and arrested. They missed the burial service. In a statement released by the ACLU, Lewis Loudon said he could never express the shame and humiliation he and his wife felt when they were arrested. And there's more to the story, but you catch the drift of it.
I like the juxtaposition, Robert. I think that the way people die by being cooped up in cupboards worse than chickens are in these days, and the way that they're buried, which is an extortion racket in and of itself, like in the way insurance companies play out, that's an area that real anarchists, if they had the chance, might address. People don't even know they can make up their own memorial service. There's very few laws, you know. There's just these antiquated traditions, and everybody pays for it because they're in shock when the mortician and everyone else in there with their hands out hits you up.
Here's a little something on economics. Bankruptcy Obama style, calling the U.S. bankrupt is insulting, by Jay Barr. An empire that spends money it does not have on a hyper-bloated military it does not need might seem to fit the description of bankrupt. However, calling the U.S. bankrupt is an insult, or an insult, if you will, to all those who actually file bankruptcy. As a consumer bankruptcy attorney, apparently this guy Jay Barr is a consumer bankruptcy attorney, I can personally attest to the circumstances and conditions surrounding this financial last resort, and the United States, at least in the hands of its elected reps, does not fit the description. Generally speaking, there are two types of bankruptcy, liquidation and reorganization. Before entering into either type, the bankrupt individual must come to terms with the fact that she or he can no longer sustain the failed budget that led to financial ruin. In many cases, medical bills from our antiquated health care system are the cause. In others, debtors rely on easy credit that snowballs into an unmanageable amount of debt that is a lifetime of minimum payments that a lifetime of minimum payments could not repay. Whether liquidating or reorganizing, a debtor who desires bankruptcy protection must provide a list of expenses, which, if considered reasonable, are offset against income to show that only limited funds are available to repay the bankrupted creditors. Now, imagine a person filing for bankruptcy claiming that he could not repay his debts because he had the astronomical expense of maintaining at least 737 facilities overseas that provide exactly zero return on the significant investment required to sustain them, that is to say, 737 military bases. These bases are filled with gas-guzzling vehicles, as well as employees who, as compensation for their many sacrifices, understandably receive a lifetime of costly benefits. This debtor could not possibly qualify for reorganization under the good faith requirements of bankruptcy until he stopped sinking funds into overseas money pits. He could not qualify for liquidation without turning over many of his assets for the benefit of his creditors, including the valuable foreign real estate on which he placed the bases. In either case, for a debtor to be bankrupt, he or she must take affirmative action and admit that there is a problem. In addition to the apparent American inability to rein in military spending, another factor that might discourage the U.S. from being bankrupt is the sizable amount of non-dischargeable debt it has amassed, much of which is not even officially recognized as debt. One of the safeguards in bankruptcy for certain classes of creditors is the designation of certain types of debt as non-dischargeable, meaning a bankruptcy has no effect on the obligation. Some debtors are discouraged from filing bankruptcy if a substantial amount of the debt will remain even after filing. An important type of debt is traditionally recognized as non-dischargeable is injury caused by willful or malicious conduct of the debtor. Clearly, in just the past 8 years, the U.S. has incurred a large amounts of this type of debt with a war of choice in Iraq, aerial bombings in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and the torture regime from Guantanamo to Bagram and all the black sites in between. A third factor that could discourage the U.S. from being bankrupt is the number of avoidable transfers that have taken place. An avoidable transfer is essentially a gift or other transfer of property or cash to another party in exchange for minimal or no value in return, a gift that obviously comes at the expense of creditors. Billions of dollars in, quote, aid to nations like Israel and Georgia with nothing received in return while the U.S. runs massive deficits would be avoidable, meaning a bankruptcy trustee could undo the transfer and force the recipient to return the money or property for redistribution to all creditors. And we know our government could never live with that terrifying prospect. Thus far, President Obama has not distinguished himself from any of his predecessors as he has proposed increasing rather than decreasing the Bush-era military budget. With a spineless Democratic Congress better at printing money than cutting wasteful spending, and a Republican minority with no better ideas than continuing the failed policies of 2001 through 8, I do not expect the United States to commit to the difficult self-analysis required to be bankrupt. Until we have real change, we will remain an insolvent nation, not a bankrupt one. And that's a story about why the U.S. is not really bankrupt, even though it's going down, 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 by Jay Barr, the bankruptcy lawyer. What's your thoughts about this, Linda? You ever declared bankruptcy?
No, but I used to work on the... I worked as a paralegal for individual real people who were declaring bankruptcy. Usually they had a business that failed. On the average, most of them had a business that had failed. And so I know more about it than anybody wants to. It makes your dreams bad. But, you know, my first thought, of course, was, well, it's the government we're talking about. The state's the one that makes up these bankruptcy rules, picks those judges about that who are going to oversee your bankruptcy settlement.
The state would have the same standard for itself as
for
other people.
Why would you ever think that?
Oh, come. I mean, you wouldn't claim that they have a double standard, Linda. The cynic in this.
Oh, there are many standards, but I think that I'm trying to make the point that the congressmen individually exempt themselves from the standards they promulgate. Of course, the state as a whole is going to do the same thing. They made it up. We bow to it. You know those undissolvable debts you mentioned?
Well, I think we have
those
to.
Those are like the IRS.
I think we have to agree that, yeah, I mean, that they are... I think it's interesting, though, the kind of comparisons he makes. Here's another story, marijuana legalization in Mexico. Mexico's legalization solution by Ian Grillo, who's writing from Mexico City. As Mexico suffers from the worst drug-related bloodshed in its history, a growing number of politicians and pundits are calling for the government to take a radical turn in its war on drugs, legalization. In recent months, two left-leaning parties have filed bills in the Mexican Congress on the issue, one advocating the decriminalization of marijuana for personal use, and the other of both soft and hard drugs, including cocaine and heroin. The proposals come amid a rising tide of opinion to rethink drug prohibition across Latin America, where drug violence has affected different countries in fits and bursts for three decades. Elsa Conde, the federal congresswoman who filed the marijuana bill in Mexico, told Al Jazeera, that's a news agency that's reporting this story, that the measure would be a realistic first step towards a wider international policy on the drug trade. We need to look at new ways of stopping all these billions of dollars going to the gangsters, she said. Mexican drug gangs make an estimated $30 billion trafficking drugs to the U.S. However, there is a growing local market in narcotics, particularly in marijuana, cocaine, and crack in Mexico itself. Her initiative advocates that people be allowed up to 3.5 grams of marijuana or to grow up to 3 plants in their homes. Under current Mexican law, possession is not a specific crime, but a judge can hand out a prison term for possession of any amount of drugs on the pretext that they are dealing. While Conde is not overly optimistic her bill would be approved in the short term, she at least hopes it will help fuel debate on the issue on both sides of the border. The first step is to decriminalize the debate, she said. Then we may be able to change the policy bit by bit. In February, former presidents of Brazil, Colombia, and Mexico signed a statement calling for decriminalization so that addicts would turn from buyers in the illegal market to patients cared for in the public health system. It is imperative to rectify the war on drugs strategy pursued in the region over the past 30 years, it said. Current drug repression policies are firmly rooted in prejudices, fears, and ideological visions. The statement was particularly pertinent as it was backed by Cesar Gaviria, the former Colombian president who oversaw the police killing of one of the most notorious drug lords of all time, Pablo Escobar. The three elder statesmen stressed that the widespread violence in Mexico, which has seen 7,000 drug-related killings since January 2008, was a sign that urgent new action is needed. Legalization advocates in Mexico and South America point their fingers at the U.S. for leading drug prohibition and bullying other countries into towing their line. The phrase war on drugs was first coined by Richard Nixon, the then U.S. president in 1969. It has defined a policy in which the U.S. has poured money into Latin American governments, waging violent crackdowns on traffickers such as in Colombia, and cut off funds for others. The U.S. angered many Latin American countries with its certification program enacted in 1986, which imposed sanctions on those states not considered to be fully cooperating with U.S. anti-narcotics efforts. Reforms under the administration of George Bush, the former U.S. president, softened the process so the government would go only after the worst offending countries. But the Bush administration also attacked Evo Morales, the Bolivian president, for his policy of encouraging the growing of coca leaves. In November, Morales, who once chewed coca leaves at a U.N. conference, expelled the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency office from Bolivia. In 2006, Mexico's Congress approved a previous bill that would have decriminalized small quantities of marijuana, cocaine, and other drugs. But, under pressure from the White House, Vicente Fox, the former Mexican president, refused to sign the bill into law. We need to create a policy that is more autonomous from the United States, said Conde. After all, it is here in Latin America that we are suffering from all the killing and intimidation of the drug war. However, Conde conceded that change is also needed in consumer countries like the U.S. if they are to cut off the drug cartel's main source of income. Cross-border opposition. In January, the City Council of El Paso, Texas, across the Mexican border from the violence-racked Ciudad Juarez, passed a resolution calling for the U.S. Congress to engage in an open, honest national dialogue on ending the prohibition of narcotics. The El Paso mayor promptly killed the motion with a veto. And mayors of several U.S. cities near the border said they would be concerned about Americans crossing the Rio Grande to take drugs if they were legal in Mexico. Likewise, many Mexican politicians stand firmly against the new proposals. In times when we have an economic crisis and all this violence, it is foolish distraction to talk about things like legalizing drugs, said Alejandro Munoz, a congressman from the Conservative National Action Party, or PAN. Felipe Calderón, the Mexican president who is leading a national crackdown, has filed his own bill that would make drug addicts go to compulsory rehabilitation after the first offense and face prison terms for the second. But I think we're going to have to turn to the main subject of this evening, which is Fresno and what's cooking there. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Linda and Robert.
Robert, this is Mike Rhodes, Fresno.
Mike Rhodes, the cutter and trimmer who's working with poverty pimps in Fresno?
You say so.
Well, I don't know. I'm just taking.
Don't leave it up to him, Mike.
Thank you.
So Mike, let's. We haven't heard. Jeremy hasn't called in yet. He's one of the, not one of your critics, but one of the critics of some of the. What's the nature of this dispute? Why don't you define it for us, and then I'll criticize you.
Well, I might say something that you like, and then you'd be stuck having to criticize it. But anyway.
I can criticize. I'll find
anyway,
something.
You can take either side of the issue.
At the same time.
So here we are in Fresno. The city policy has been to bulldoze the encampments, harass the homeless, make them either want to leave town, die, or get into one of their programs run by evangelical Christians. We had a lawsuit against them. We won. They had to stop some of that stuff that they were doing, specifically the bulldozing.
I mean, actually, we've talked about this, Mike, at length, that you won the $2.3 million lawsuit, which now requires them to store homeless property, and in fact has given real damage money and some money to a few, a certain number of homeless people, you know, in response to the losses they've suffered. We've noticed the emergence of homeless encampments, the H Street encampment, the New Jack City encampment. I guess there's others as well, which homeless people have been.
All that's true. And then what they're doing now, and where I was going to with that, is that the city of Fresno has now come up with a plan to provide homeless people with vouchers to get them out of these encampments that they're living in. The city right now is looking at providing vouchers for, I think, an initial 200 people, which is admittedly a drop in the bucket, but it's a hell of a lot better than where we were 2 years ago when they were bulldozing encampments.
How long?
So all I'm saying is that, you know...
Linda's got a question for you.
Okay.
Mike, how long are these vouchers good for?
Well, the theory is that they're good indefinitely, but right now what Greg Barfield, who is the homelessness czar here in Fresno, he's hired by the city to carry this program out, he told me at first it was going to be indefinitely, as long as people needed them. That there's going to be no strings attached. People don't have to, do anything to, enroll in a program or anything, that this would be indefinite. He has since modified that in the last week, and now he's saying that they have funding for 2 or 3 months right now, but they're hoping that they'll be able to continue it on beyond that.
Let's talk about the funding. We've talked about this before, Mike, that millions of dollars in homeless money from the federal government has been left unspent by the city of Fresno, correct?
That's true, yes.
Right. So now you have all this money in a nice big pool, and they're telling you they can only take care of... And we're talking about, 300 or 400 people in these, 200 people in these encampments, right, or in this one encampment?
There's probably 200 to 300 people there. I think that's where he gets that 200 number from, is he's figuring there's about 200 people.
Right. So my suspicion here is that usually when the government moves to take care of, to remove something like Camp Paradise, or wants to get rid of, in Santa Cruz, the Coral Street open-air shelter, or wants to eliminate... in Ontario, they're fencing off the tent city down there, or in Reno when they go after the tent city there, or in Sacramento. You're probably familiar with that, too. They really want to eliminate the visible tent city where homeless people have actually gotten together to help each other and to create a sustainable survival environment. It seems to me that if you're an advocate for the homeless, you would tell these clowns, frankly, as I call them, these bureaucrats who have more money than they know what to do with, and they're spending it on surveys instead of on actual assistance for homeless people, to go after the people that are not in encampments, who don't have the kind of at least minimal security and mutual community support. What do you think about that, Linda?
Well, I don't think it should be either or, one or the other, you know. But, Mike, this is a typical tactic. They did it here in... With smaller camps. They did it with a Food Not Bombs. They interfered so that the Food Not Bombs group got divided up, and then promised the new shoot-off group an indoor kitchen until the energy, that human energy was diffused. And then they said, oh, well, we couldn't find one. You know, they've done things like that over and over, and it's a tendency. I mean, I'm not blaming people like calling those clowns or anything like Robert did, but there's a tendency to hang on to it and sit on it. And if you come in with creative solutions, it's harder for them to do it, but it's just a built-in tendency that we're up against. And until the public, the broad citizen base, understands how many people are homeless, not just how many people are on the TV news, but the total, some sense of the severity of this problem, if you will, they're not going to do anything but try to make the problem look less obvious. You know, if the people break up and go away, even for a week, these people will pat themselves on the back and do whatever they had planned to do all along until the people that have nothing get organized again. So it's just, I'm just saying, beware.
Right, well, that's a reasonable warning. One of the dynamics here is that this encampment, which is on Union Pacific Railroad property, has been completely enclosed with barbed wire and razor wire fencing, and Union Pacific is saying they're going to force people out soon, and they sort of told the city that they're going to do that, and the city is trying to do this voucher thing to give people an alternative place to go rather than just being scattered to the winds.
Or rather than just siding with the people that are out there against the rail people.
It seems to me that the solution to that is you get some damn clippers, you cut down the barbed wire, and, you know, you engage in solidarity with the people inside these encampments, or you put so much media publicity on Union Pacific they can't possibly do that, and you pressure the people who have the big bags of money that they're using to essentially collude with Union Pacific in their homeless removal program. You use it instead to get people who have not even this minimal thing at Union Pacific there available. I picked up on that idea. And I'm looking at it. Let me read you, Mike, a little bit of what Jeremy Alderson, who was going to appear on this show or speak on this show, but may not be able to get through, or maybe he's forgotten, or maybe he's having dinner, who knows, or sleeping. I guess he's in New York or something, right?
That's 3 hours time difference.
Yeah, he's probably gallivanting around town with some floozy. But in any case, here's
that
what he
sounds like, Jeremy.
No, is that you say it does sound like Jeremy?
No,
we don't know.
Loses unite.
All right. Well, let's hope he has
name
some.
Name the woman before she even exists.
Indeed, or the man. The man. They haven't heard of floozy men. All right. Well, let's not be sexist.
Heard of slut men.
Let's not be homophobic here in our descriptions. Anyway, he writes this letter to me, to you, Mike, which I also CC'd to me, and it reads as follows: Mike, do I understand this correctly? You estimate there could be as many as 15,000 homeless in the Fresno area, and they are offering vouchers to 200. And this at a time when even the relative calm is being disrupted by the closure of a major encampment. If the actual number of homeless in Fresno is only 2,000, this would still be offering to help only 10%. I just don't understand the point of getting on board for 10%. Let them try to talk us down to 90. Moreover, why don't we give them credit for having some good impulses? Let's just, for the sake of argument, say we want to help them solve the problem and they really want to do it. What kind of help are we giving them if we tell them that 10% is a solution? Personally, I think they need to be kindly and gently told that we can't get on board until they present a solution that actually solves the problem. Solving this problem isn't illegal. As has been said, I believe, by more than one person on this list, there has to be the political will. But where will the politicians get the political will if even the activists don't have it? Now, okay. The point here, I think, is A, not mentioned but very relevant here, is how much money do these folks actually have available? It sounds like they've got a shitload of money available here. I mean, I'm not sure the city has several million dollars available, right?
Well, I think they budgeted $3 million in this year's budget to address homeless housing.
Right.
So I don't think that it's a matter of the money. I think it's really the political will that's lacking at City Hall deal with this problem.
Unfortunately, I hear that same thing. I hear that, and you're right, of course, but I hear that same thing from every politician that we've attempted to get to, let's say, put the sleeping ban on the agenda in Santa Cruz to change it. Oh, there isn't the political will to do that. No, I mean...
Or the votes.
You know, or the votes. We haven't got the votes. That's nice, but the fact of the matter is you are in a position, and your organization and the organizations that are allied with, you know, with you... and not to mention the media and the with the financial resources are there more than any other city that I can think of at this time to actually force this city to take some real action, like set up some real massive tent cities. If they want to move people away from Union Pacific, then they need to set. I'm sure Fresno has large bunches of abandoned housing, huge pieces of property where they could set up an alternate tent city. So all this is there. I think what you need to do is, in the manner, speaking as the distant fellow who will give you lots of advice and do absolutely nothing substantive to help you.
And we appreciate that,
Robert. Course, of course. My advice is of course, more precious than gold. You know, I mean, remember what Portland did. Dignity Village got everybody in shopping carts, and they marched to a public park. And they set up a campsite there. And then when the authority said you have to move, they got their shopping carts again, and they rolled down the road to another public park. In other words, it became a way of advertising both what was happening, showing that they were hanging together in solidarity and weren't going to be bought off, and essentially separated, because that's what this is. This is a separation of a community. These people being given motel vouchers are being broken up. The power is being dispersed. Make no mistake about it. That's what it looks like to me, again.
That's what they do. That's what they feel they have to do. That's what they did in Scott's Creek, and I've never seen an exception, Robert. But Mike, his ideas, though great, I think, have to be tempered, and you probably know this already, with, you know, working with activists who have learned or know how to cohere as a group. And being careful, because there are people in this population we're talking about who are in many ways fragile. And you don't want to set someone up with warrants or jail time that doesn't know what they're getting into. So you have to be more effective than these people that are getting paid for being ineffectual to even keep your presence going when you've got some reason to do so.
My advice to people at the H Street encampment is that if they get evicted from there, is they should go to City Hall and camp out.
What do they say?
Well, see, and it kind of goes back to some of what this discussion has been, that people who are homeless have, you know, they're fragile for different reasons, and you know, people are afraid. A lot of the people at this encampment, probably over half of them, are from Mexico. I don't know for certain, but I suspect that a lot of them are undocumented.
Illegal, possibly.
For them to go and camp out at City Hall and cause a confrontation, which would cause a crisis and would probably get the city to deal with this, would put them in a position of being deported. Other people have outstanding warrants or other issues. It's a very difficult, in Fresno at least. Maybe it's different other places, but
no,
I found it very difficult here, to develop leadership from, the homeless people themselves. And that's really the one element that we're really lacking here is people's ability to organize and carry out a campaign and a strategy to put the pressure on the city that would be necessary to establish these free zones, which is something that I've argued relentlessly for years, that that's really the first thing that the city has to do, is to just say, okay, this park, you know, because there are so many homeless in Fresno, we are going to open it up to camping. There are toilets here. There is drinking water. There is trash pickup. We're going to make this place as livable as possible for this group.
Let me ask.
They haven't done that.
Let me ask you, Mike. What you know? You have a bunch of Fresno homeless advocates. How many advocates would you say? I mean, because I see this email list where people, intelligent-sounding folks who sound pretty persuaded. How many alive bodies do you have? Be willing to come down to City Hall and stand with homeless people in these actions, counting
it would
you.
It would depend on the circumstances, but we had a sleep-in at City Hall a year or two ago, and we probably had 100, 150 people that came for that.
That's housed people.
It was a mixture. It was both homeless people and people that are advocates that have housing.
That's enough to change the world if they're willing to take risks and able.
That was
a good event. There are homeless people that have some leadership skills that I think they need to be developed, and if you could create a movement with the people that are here, and you have, as I think Robert said, maybe 15,000 homeless people in Fresno, and I think that's a reasonable number. If you can get just, 1,000 of them to march on City Hall at any one given time, you would be able to secure the shit out of the powers that be.
Well, I don't think you can get that, though, in advance. It seems to me that the way you get that is you have a few dedicated people, often housed people and homeless people, perhaps some of those who won the Fresno Kincaid lawsuit, who set up a campsite outside City Hall. And they say, we're here, we're not going away. And we invite homeless people who have no place to come here and, let's say, present their credentials to this poverty pimp who's spending $50,000 on a triage survey to find out how many people actually need housing and what their real needs are. In other words, you could set up your own sort of, and not only can they come down and advise this wonderful czar or whoever his assistant is as to what they need, but they can keep their asses planted there, and housed people can be supportive by purchasing tents, by having computers and access to media, by putting out their own network of phone calls and phone support, by peppering the city council with emails and so forth, by letting us and other cities know what's going on. In other words, I think if you set it up, if you build it, they will come, as they say.
It's possible.
And I saw that work. I've seen that happen in the recent past and in the ancient past here on the same campus of the City Hall, which I never thought was the ideal place. You want it where regular people can see you, too. But
City Hall in Fresno is where? Is it visible?
It's,
sorry.
It's really visible, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
our City Hall isn't very visible. It's kind
let
of.
Let me try to finish. So what I saw happen, Mike, is... once they lasted more than 48 hours or even maybe a little less, then all kinds of people would bring down their piroshkis from their restaurant when it closed, come down with their guitar and loan it around in the evening. Women from some Catholic school came down and just wandered around the people who were there talking. And, of course, lots of homeless people came. And what I saw that helped is... people from different persuasions that may be against it or may have concerns about how it was being done, as long as they can rap with people, with their peers, with some of the bureaucrats or the so-called leaders, if there's a freedom and there's a visibility, you have a really good chance of keeping it going. And eventually, maybe it'll get busted. That's one of the potential outcomes. But if you work ahead and you're clear who's in a position, to take a ticket even, or who's in a position to accept it if they want to carry people off, then right. Everyone else knows they just, back up and be good witnesses or whatever their role is. You can't expect everyone to be ready for the whole tamale.
In other words,
I don't think it's reasonable for us to simply expect the city of Fresno to provide 10,000-15,000 vouchers for homeless people indefinitely. I don't think that's going to happen. They're going to need a lot of political pressure and probably a crisis or two along the way to
get them to do
anything.
Wait a minute. Stop right there. Why isn't it reasonable? Do they have the money to do it? Is there the millions of dollars set aside to do it? Isn't that the responsibility that they're supposed to have? Why isn't it reasonable?
So what I said was that I don't think it's reasonable for us to expect them to just do it on their own.
It's reasonable for you to demand that it be done. I think that's the point that Jeremy Alderson, who's not on our show, we're talking with Mike Rhodes, by the way, for those of you who just tuned in to Free Radio, 101.1 FM and Freak Radio. Mike is in Fresno. He's been presented with possible 200 vouchers as they attempt to essentially get rid of an encampment, in a homeless encampment that's been functioning for, what, a year and a half now, 2 years?
Yeah,
after a successful lawsuit was won that essentially stopped sleeping ban legislation and also illegal confiscation of homeless property, the Kincaid decision. Linda wanted to say something.
Mike, I agree with you. I don't think you want them to do it on their own. You know, they need to work on being more transparent, and then whoever you can get that can stand talking with them in a public setting or however they run their committees. You want those people as involved as possible, and you want to support them emotionally because maybe they don't feel like behaving because this is real life they're talking about, and it's just a job to the other guys. So, I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but you want to be involved. You want to formalize your involvement, and you want to make it stick, but you have to have some person power on your side to do that, and hopefully at least one on the inside. That helps.
Also, another question, Mike, is what do homeless people want? You do have some activists who are homeless. I've had them on the show, Al Williams.
Uh-huh.
You had what, 50 or 60 homeless people who went to the city council in Madera?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you have a certain number of activists who are homeless themselves who I don't know whether they have you know, significant positions in the homeless community. I don't know how many of them speak Spanish. You know, I don't know how many of them are illegal or legal immigrants. But, you know, you can always offer something to the homeless community. You can say, we're offering, we think this is the best way to go. I mean, you can take a couple of roads. You can say, we believe you have to provide a real alternative pressure on the city. Something like, as you say, this tent city, and we're going to set it up and we'll see if anyone comes. Or you can say, well, we see it's not realistic. There's not enough political will right now. We're going to work with the 200 vouchers. We're going to hope that things are going to get better. We'll keep, you know, the phone calls and letters coming. In other words, or some third alternative. In other words, you and the activists can present an alternative that you yourselves can make. And then the homeless people themselves and their activists will make the choice as to what they want to do. And, you know, you may be slapped down, but it still may be worth trying. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I obviously have a predilection for these kinds of solutions, particularly when I don't have to abandon watching television and eating meals myself indoors because I don't have to go to Fresno. Although, frankly, if you set it up, I probably would look in on what you were doing, maybe even with a sleeping bag, you know.
Well, maybe you could come for a month and work with us and help build this movement
If you set it up... If you actually started doing it, I would certainly help you publicize it, and I would probably certainly come visit. How long I would stay, you know, would depend upon the creature comforts you presented to a man of my years and experience.
Get your own tent, Robert, just like everybody else.
I guess, yeah, that would be what happened. Another thing...
Mike, I want to say something that Robert will disagree with, I'll bet you, but I think it's as important as all the things we've all been talking about, and that is... This is a conflict in a manner of speaking, so you don't want to corner the people that you're trying to get something much greater from. They need to feel like there's an out so that your guys can keep the thing going with them.
There obviously
is an out. Who are you talking about? Are you talking about...
talking about the bureaucrats, the poverty pimps, and the people, and the politicians. That's who you're talking about, right, Linda?
Well, since you put it that way, I demur.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's who she's talking about, I think.
Or whoever is willing to get out front and say, we can't have this camp going on, or whatever is the resistance. You don't want to corner, I mean, somebody wants to, but you don't, as a mass group, want to corner the person. Just expose their lies. Don't pick on them, but expose them.
Uh-huh. Their lies have been exposed for the last 2 years. That's what Mike and these activists have been doing. It's not a matter of exposing their lies. It's a matter of challenging what they're doing and saying, we're finding our own solutions because you aren't finding solutions. We are finding solutions, and this is the solution we're choosing. We're not going to wait for you. We're going ahead with this. Now, what they will immediately try to do is they will then increase the number of vouchers they're offering, particularly to the people who are directly down at City Hall. They will want to remove the protest, just like they want to remove the encampment. This is not about dealing with homelessness at all in Fresno. It's about dealing with homeless protest in Fresno.
So, Robert, do you think that people should not take these vouchers?
Oh, no. I think anybody who wants a voucher should take it. But I think that, you know, those, I think that what, I mean, what you really want to do is establish your own system of finding people who are the most vulnerable yourself. Just like you had the, you know, the folk, that the woman who was determining how much money was to be given out of the Kincaid settlement for different,
right,
five different tiers. You yourselves, you know, have homeless people come to you and say, I need this, I need that. You look over their medical records or their, you know, you listen to other people who know them. And you yourself say, you know, you evolve your own system, kind of like a union of the homeless. You create a new, that's been done,
yeah,
before in Oakland. There was a union of the homeless there. There was a union of the homeless in San Jose. They took over buildings. You're in a position now where there's really significant motivation here, maybe not good motivation in a way, because it's money and money corrupts. And vouchers are not housing, as has been pointed out time and time again.
You realize these vouchers are not for motels and hotels.
What are they for?
The idea is that there'll be apartments, something.
First and last security deposits on apartments?
You know, it's hard to say. That's what
it shouldn't be hard to say. Wait a minute, Mike. Let me interrupt you. It shouldn't be hard to say. I mean, you know, I mean, the guy who's presenting this shit to you, I'm sorry, these proposals to you, what's the man's name?
Greg Barfield.
Greg should know this from the word go. And there shouldn't be any question if either he has the power to do this or he doesn't, how much control he has over the money. I mean, these are issues that shouldn't be really be vague, and I'm not sure why they're vague. But since,
it's been shifting, I wish that it wasn't shifting. I mean, first he said that this would be indefinitely, and now he's saying that they have money for 2 or 3 months. I can't help them.
They all do that.
You're not calling Greg shifty, are you?
That's just the way that it is.
Yeah.
Mike, let me throw you a question. If you have, say, X number of dollars, or whoever has it, you have access to it, more, you might find you can do more to help people that are already out with a building or a couple or a facility, I'm trying to say, than giving each of them a voucher. I mean, I'm assuming you have a better rental rate than we have here, and the vouchers could be very helpful. But what about for the people that have been blackballed by landlords, or the people that actually need some help, either from the system or from relatives or from a church, to afford to stay once they're in there? If you have charge, I hate to sound like a capitalist pig here, but if you have control, your people have control over a facility, even just for a year or two, then you can help the people that otherwise are just going to get lost in the woodwork.
And again,
right,
we talk about,
it's a full-time plus thing. It can wipe you out more.
I don't feel we've been entirely fair with you, Mike, by just throwing all this at you. I mean, thank you for giving us an opportunity to, you know, vent our concerns, and we probably need to hear more from you about the actual meat and potatoes of what is being offered, as well as the shifts and the offers. The problem is we have like 3 minutes left in the show, and I know you got out of a meeting late, so you couldn't call in earlier.
Well, I'm still kind of stuck at that meeting. I just stepped out to talk with you.
I am going to be on the air tomorrow between 10 and noon, doing a special version of Bathroom Spares Broadsides tomorrow. So in case you want to call in and continue this, you can, although I wouldn't blame you if you didn't.
Well, guess what I'm going to be doing tomorrow afternoon, hand permitting? I'm going to be at the housing subcommittee, which I'm on, of the HAP, the Continuum of Care here.
That's the
looking
hapless
at the
poverty
Obama
bills.
Money that apparently is moving fast.
Right.
For homelessness, I mean.
So
yeah.
So you can either get back to me tomorrow between 10 and 12, or you can, on Sunday morning, I have a longer period of time, you may be available or not. And I promise this time when you call in, I will try to shut up and let you actually express your concerns. Maybe we can even get Jeremy to call in. He was supposed to. He sent me several emails. Maybe we're having a problem with the phone lines.
Yeah, maybe. He lives in rural New York. They could be having a snowstorm there.
And I think he wanted me to call in on an 800 number, and I didn't do that. So,
yeah.
But I did tell him I wanted him to call me. So maybe we can get him to call again. It's a really, you know, you have a lot of opportunity. It's not, obviously, you're just one person in this whole thing, but you're, you know, you've done a lot of the work here. You have inside information on what's going on. And your voice is an important one here, I think, in determining public opinion. That's why we're trying to influence your opinion. You know,
yes.
So.
Well, it's always good to get outside ideas, because when you're in just one place, it's easy to get isolated and you don't hear other ideas. So that's why I like talking to you, Robert. And cool. You know, you give me new ideas that I wouldn't get otherwise. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Well,
I'll try to call you on Sunday. I can't call you tomorrow.
All right. So if the folks want to continue listening to this discussion, you can also go for more background on the prior struggles and journalistic and photographic expeditions of Mike Rhodes, who I'm talking to. You can go to indiebay.org/Central Valley. That's Central Valley Indie Media. And just look up, I guess, the most recent stories on homelessness, and you generally have a sort of a backlog. You can go back. You can follow the earlier stories, right, Mike?
That's correct, yeah. So usually any article you see on Indie Bay, you can click on a link that will give you all of the previous stories.
Well, I want to thank you for calling in, and I also, if Jeremy talks to you, I apologize to him for us not being able to get him on. Tell him I guess I'll email him and invite him to call in again, maybe 10 o'clock on Sunday morning.
Yeah, sure, that sounds good.
Linda's got some words.
Hang
here.
In there, Mike. You're doing a great job.
Thanks, Linda. Appreciate it. Talk to you later, Robert.
Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye.
And that's about it for Bathrop Spears Broadsides. The man who creams off the dregs, or dregs off the cream, is arrived, and he's got his booze with him, so I'd watch out. You know, the alcohol problems are skyrocketing in Santa Cruz, and I don't know if Uncle Dennis, whose uncle he is, I don't know, is actually contributing to this situation or not. But Uncle Dennis will give you the full story, or perhaps part of the full story, when he comes in here. Go ahead, Uncle Dennis. He's actually going to interrupt my show yet again with some kind of commentary. Go ahead, Dennis.
Well, I just wanted to point out that I got the name Uncle Dennis because when Free Radio Santa Cruz was broadcasting from a kitchen just off of Ocean Street, mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember those days.
Very vaguely.
There were a couple of children born in the house, sons and daughters of programmers. And
you had some incestuous relationship with the parents of these people?
No, I was just present at the birth of their children.
Ah, so you're more of a symbolic uncle.
A symbolic uncle, and I became
Or perhaps they were just all crying, uncle, uncle, as they...
Well, if they were trying to find humor in my jokes or your commentary,
which can
they
be
probably
difficult.
Are crying uncle.
Yes. Well, Uncle Dennis is coming up with From the Cream to the Dregs. Any special stuff this evening we should be looking forward to? Music tonight. You've had enough of us babbling, I suppose. Now we're going to turn to...
At 10 o'clock, Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd and...
First album.
The first album of Pink Floyd, or whatever that may be. I never quite knew what is a Pink Floyd. Well, we'll find out, perhaps, if you stay tuned to Uncle Dennis, who's got a bigger collection of music than almost anybody in town. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I will be back tomorrow between 10 and noon, doing old interviews, which should be extremely exciting for those of you who like old interviews. Actually, this is probably interesting stuff that you may be able to check out. It'll be archived for those of you who don't usually tune in at that time. And I'll be back on Sunday for another edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And Cop Watch will be copping a watch at the Cops on Saturday at 5 o'clock in front of Borders. That's immediately after the 3 o'clock meeting of the Human Rights Organization at the Sub Rosa Cafe. Thanks for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides.